Group meeting, Sunday, 8th March, 1987. Let there be no illusions regarding the nature and the spiritual stature of the great teachers. They who could help disciples to realize the unconditioned and awaken to the transcendent were themselves in living communion with the Supreme. In the scriptures can be read the signs of the Holy Ones, for the inward real experiencing of communion is exoterically expressed in several of the great affirmations that they made. Now, as regards this statement, the teachers could help their disciples to realize the unconditioned and awaken to the transcendent. This awakening to the transcendent is a limited thing, because what is transcendent for us will not necessarily, in fact, I'm sure, will not be transcendent to those who come long after us and are very much more evolved than us. Because what does the transcendent mean? It means that which is beyond my ken at the moment. But the history of the human race and one's own life experience shows that that which is beyond our ken now does come within our ken at some time or other, if we proceed in the practical, sensible way of realizing what is beyond our ken. So, what is transcendent for us human beings at present, for example, just holistic consciousness, that will come within our ken as time goes on. But the knowledge of that coming within our ken of holistic consciousness has to be spread. And that is one of the tasks for each and every one of us who is really interested in religious living, which means, of course, essentially in true human living. We say, humanum est errare, it is human to err. It is not human to err. It is subhuman. We, as we are still subhumans. Because the word human essentially means the happy creator. And who is regarded as the happy creator? We talk of God as being creator and in bliss always. All right. We are not blissful creators unless and except when we possess some great artistic or scientific or philosophical gift and are able to produce that imperfection and present it to the world. Then we feel happy, we feel blissful. You see, and as far as that goes, the meaning of the word human as blissful creator is fulfilled. But most of us are not like that. Most of us are so conditioned that we know so much suffering. Dukkha is the Pali word for suffering. Now, you know, the word dukkha is derived from duh, meaning bad or spoilt, and kha comes in the Upanishadic writings also, stands for the infinite and therefore the eternal. The infinite eternal spoilt is dukkha, suffering, sorrow, misery, grief, all the rest of it. You see, and since we humans ordinarily are far from the eternal, we are in a state of suffering, even though outwardly we may experience so much pleasure, which we call happiness. Well, happiness, pleasure, joy, all these words have the same sort of meaning. But it is a happiness which is not permanent. It will be difficult to find even 100 people in the world who enjoy a permanent peace of mind, a blissful state within themselves. There may be a few, but only a very few. And there are more than 5,000 millions of us on the globe nowadays. And that's a lot. So now, to realize the unconditioned, what for us would be unconditioned is not by any means an unconditioned for whatsoever nature may bring forth that is more evolved than us, more developed. We, as compared with most of the animal species, are certainly far more developed, you see. And we can understand the meaning of our conditioning and deal with it. If we deal with it in the right way, we are relatively unconditioned. So do not take these words as an ultimate absolute truth. All these statements have only a relative value. Everything has only a relative value. You know how the word God is described in the various religions. If you look at that word, if you look at the descriptions given of God in the various religions, what will you find? They are projections out of man's brain of an apotheosized human being. That is all. I can love, therefore God is absolute love. What the good things in me are absolute for the God projected out of my brain. But we leave out all the ill things in me with that conception. And it is a conspiracy on the part of all human beings never to ascribe evil to God. But if you look at your scriptures carefully, you will find it stated distinctly that, well, for instance, in Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7, the Lord God tells Isaiah, I make the light, I make darkness. I create the good, I create the evil. Now, you can look at Deuteronomy again. I think it's chapter 30, verses 19 and 22. Look at them carefully and see what is said there. But those things are not they are not sufficiently noticed and sufficiently investigated by organized, established religion. Otherwise, the establishers would be out of job very quickly. Now, take one of these affirmations. It is said in Genesis chapter 1 that Adam lived so many years and he died. Then his son Seth lived so many years and he died. And so it goes on till it comes to the seventh name, Enoch. And the name Enoch in Hebrew means tuition, intuition, the teacher. That's what Enoch means. We have, of course, our Enoch Powell, but I don't think Enoch in this sense quite applies to him. However, Enoch, it is said, and Enoch walked with God. Now, how does a human being, the seventh in the line from Adam, walk with God? What does it mean? God hasn't got two legs to walk with. It means, essentially, that here was a man, Enoch, who, through living the religious life in the real sense, realize that state of holistic consciousness which enabled him to be in harmony with that which was transcendent, the transcendent possible for any human being. Other cases are Elijah, Elisha, and so on. I'm just talking of the Bible. But if you read, if you study the Upanishads, all the Hindu scriptures, the Buddhist teachings, and so on, you will see that in the course of the last 6,000 years at least, there have been hundreds of truly spiritual people who had realized the apex point of human development and evolution, had exemplified the true meaning of the word human. These were the perfected holy ones, as they are quite rightly called. Then we have the statement, Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Oh, I'm sorry, I should have finished about Enoch. And then it goes on. It doesn't say that Enoch died after so many years. And Enoch was not, for God took him. Now, the ordinary man in the street might feel like being facetious and say, where did God take Enoch? No address, no telephone number given. You see, so where did God take him? It simply means that in that state of holistic consciousness, you experience reality in a manner which is transcendent to our experience here. And that transcendent experience of reality is of such a nature that it belongs to and can help others to be completely purified and thus realize what is possible for human beings at the present stage of evolution to realize. Neanderthalers never could have realized what has been realized during the last 6,000 years. An Australian man and the man where he originated, Proconsul and Australopithecus and all those creatures in Central Africa, were nowhere near this. They had just evolved out of the anthropoid ape stage. And they couldn't possibly realize such things. So there has been a development which has culminated during the last 6,000 years in the expressions which we find in scriptural writings. And they must not be taken as absolute truth. They are relative truth. They are good enough for us to go on with. So the meaning of God took him was that Enoch was capable of holistic consciousness and to stay in that consciousness as long as he wanted to stay in it. The Buddha, for instance, speaking to some of the followers of the Jain teacher, Mahavira, says to them that he can enter that state and stay in that state without moving, without eating or drinking or anything, you see, or sleeping, for 7 days and nights continuously. But he limits it to seven. You may ask, well, why does the perfected Holy One, the Enlightened One, limit it to seven? Simply because a physical body needs to have sustenance. It needs to assimilate, to eliminate, to rest, and so on. It needs all those things. Otherwise, you'd perish. Now, there is another statement. This comes in the Rig Veda first, and then in the Aitareya Upanishad. Vamadeva, one of the perfected holy ones, he was a great teacher, having ascended aloft from this world, became immortal. Yea, became immortal. The ascension is ascribed to Jesus, as you know. And even whilst the people were looking, when Jesus had said this, he was taken aloft, and a cloud received him out of sight. This cloud is really the cloud of unknowing. I'll explain that in a moment. But Vamadeva ascended aloft. The ascension has been known since Egyptian times. The phenomenon of ascension. When the Holy One enters into the profoundest meditative state possible to human beings, constituted as we are at present, then in his consciousness he ascends into that state. You can call it a descent if you like. He ascends into that state, which is the ultimate state that the human organism can realize. And that is what it means. Now, as regards Jesus and the cloud receiving out of sight, this cloud really is, the cloud of unknowing. Why do I call it the cloud of unknowing? Because when, in the course of the religious life, you are capable of entering into those profound contemplative or meditative states which ultimately transcend all expression in ordinary terms in our human life, then you know in an unknowing way, that is to say, unknowing in terms of the activity of the brain. The brain doesn't know anything about it. It doesn't mean you're unconscious of it, but that which you're conscious of is so profound, so deep, so real, that there are no thoughts, there are no words which can express that. You will find this in the writings of all the great mystics of the world, without exception, the great mystics. And there were many. Again, Joseph and Moses see or speak with the Lord face to face. That is stated openly. But it is also stated openly in Genesis that no one can see the Lord or speak with the Lord and live. And that has been interpreted, and I would positively say misinterpreted, as meaning that if you see the Lord, you will die. No, you won't. On the contrary, you will be alive as no ordinary human being is alive. Because to see the Lord face to face means that you are in the state of holistic consciousness, which doesn't kill you. Far from it. And speaking with the Lord means being at home yourself in the profoundest state of consciousness in terms of infinity and eternity. Now, where infinity is concerned, there is no here, no there. There is no this, no that. No up, no down. No forward, no backward, and so on. No attaining, no achieving, because those things apply only to the personal, separatively and isolatively consciousness of the ordinary human being. You see? And eternity, in eternity, there is no past, there is no present, there is no future. Those of you who have read along these lines will probably be inclined to say to me, eternity is expressed in the eternal now. But what is the eternal now? The eternal now is the resultant of the whole of what we call the past, and also interacting with the whole of the future in the immediate present. You see, they have said in all the religions, God is omniscient. What does this omniscience mean? God is not a super encyclopedia. There is no such person, separate individual person as God. There is a reality, a transcendent reality, on which we must not plaster our limitations. This eternal now, as I say, is the resultant of the whole of the past. The whole of the past evolved and present here at this very moment. Right here at this very moment. That is what we call the now. But it also is the whole of the future expressed in the now. Because that which draws the past out and makes it evolve and grow is the future. You see? Now you can see what prophecy means, the word prophecy means. It doesn't mean foretelling events to come. Sometimes you can foretell events to come if you are perceptive enough and sensible enough and knowledgeable enough. You can see that obviously this, that and the other is bound to happen. You see? And so you can foretell something like that. But you can't unfold the future at all. The future is not fixed. There is no such thing as predestination or predetermination of the future. Everything evolves and changes, and there is ample room because of elasticity as a characteristic of the whole universe and universal process. There is room for elasticity and therefore for chance. And that is coming along more and more into prominence through the work of modern scientists. I think all of you must have heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And that uncertainty principle was discovered with research into the nature of subatomic particles. You can take, for instance, an electron. If your experiment is directed towards finding the position of the electron, you cannot discover its momentum. Momentum is the product of the velocity of something by the mass of something. If your weight is 10 stone and you're running at the rate of 10 feet per second, then your momentum is 10 times 10. You see? Velocity multiplied by the mass. That's momentum. On the other hand, if the scientist investigates by an experiment what is the momentum of that electron, he cannot pinpoint its position. He can only say that it is likely to exist somewhere within this region. That is all. The electron cloud, as it is called. It's funny how that word cloud has all sorts of contexts in which it can be used. So there is this principle of uncertainty operating throughout the universal process. That is why foretelling an event is out of the situation. There are people, as I said earlier, who can foretell events, and they do come off. But as I say, if you have sufficient percipience, your perceptive power penetrates deeply, and you have sufficient good sense and knowledge at the same time, you can foretell certain things. It's not difficult to do that. We who are grown up can easily foretell a child. If you put your hand into the fire, you will start crying. And isn't that true? But where is the foretelling in the sense that we understand foretelling? So, eternity holds the whole of the future, drawing the past all the time, beckoning to the past. And its manifestation takes place here and now. And the here is an infinity always. When I say infinity, the natural tendency is immediately to think in terms of bigness, hugeness. It's so big, you know the good old story, the frog, which a creature came and trampled upon its little, what are they, froglets? When the mother frog came back, she asked those who were left, was it as big as this? And the frog expanded. No, much bigger, as this, until the frog burst. You see? But infinity is here now. The point is in. What does infinity mean? Not finite. The finite is measurable. The infinite is immeasurable. But your geometrical point, your true point, has no length, no breadth, no depth. It is immeasurable. It is infinite. Now, if the brain can free itself from its limitation of associating infinity with hugeness, then you will find that your sense of proportion in all the practical, ordinary things of everyday life will be sensible, will be very different. And you will find yourself much more happy, and to use a commoner garden word in the language, more successful. But beware of success. It is as bad as failure. Things happen. They evolve. And when they have come to their fruition, they must of necessity pass away and die. If you can see this and accept it, death will have no fear whatsoever for you. But you must see it inwardly. That doesn't mean that you won't feel pain at death and pain and sorrow. I shall be 85 this year. When I heard about last night's tragedy with that ferry, tears came. I couldn't stop them. Of course, that is due to sympathy, compassion, to suffer with those who suffer. And sometimes there is the physical expression of that suffering. I always tell people who have lost, as they say, their beloved or dear one or whoever it is, don't suppress your tears. Don't keep a stiff upper lip. It's a great mistake. Cry it out. Let the feeling flow out. And then there will be peace later on. And it will be a stable peace. And also there will be a truer compassion for all who suffer. That is what is necessary. Usually the ordinary man's compassion is merely pity. And pity has a looking down upon aspect to it. There'll be no looking down. You will experience your complete unity with the one who is suffering. And in that there is compassion, there is real love. That's the beginning, if you like, of transcendent love, which has no possessiveness whatsoever in it. Now, we read about the Mount of the Lord and spending 40 days and nights there. The Mount of the Lord of the Old Testament has its counterpart in the Zarathustrian Ushid Arena. Of course, our dear scholars give all sorts of wonderful explanations, geographical being one of them and so forth. But you can put that in your pocket and forget all about it. Ushid Arena refers to that state of holistic consciousness, the Mount of the Lord. The Hindu Meru, Mount Meru, the Sahasrara Chakra of Kundalini Yoga, the Brahma Loka of Buddhist meditation. This is the Mount of the Lord. The Buddha and his great disciples can spend 7 days and nights continuously in the deep communion called the cessation. And you may wonder, what is the cessation of what? It is the cessation of all perception and feeling at the subhuman level. That completely ceases. And when that completely ceases, you will discover that the brain has stopped talking. Not only whilst you are awake, but in your sleep. If you look at your thought process, which is of course an activity of the brain as such, it is always chattering, and that chatter is centered round I. You can't watch your thought process for 5 minutes without saying I 500 times. It's absolutely astonishing. It's the limiting process, you see. And it is all about things worldly, things which tie you down and prevent you from developing within yourself. You have to think of worldly things because we have to get up in the morning and take a shower or bath or a bath. We have to have breakfast. We have to go to work. We have to do all that. We have to pay attention to everything. But you see, if we learn the art of paying attention in the right way, then that attentiveness, that which will be transcendent to our ordinary attentiveness, will permeate all the other ordinary attentiveness of everyday life. And you'll be able to tackle everyday life in a much better way altogether. You see? So, the cessation. In holistic consciousness, the brain stops talking. And when the brain stops talking, mind, in its purity, in its transcendent reality, functions through you. And it functions through your brain. It transforms, actually transforms physically, some at least, of the cells of the brain. That is being investigated now, more and more, of recent years. And therefore, the disturbance which the brain normally causes in our ordinary everyday life is at an end. You see what religious living means. Rituals and prayers and genuflections and all the gestures and so on which are considered religious, they have a place in life for those whose temperament is such that it elevates them, it puts them into a sublime mood. But it is a temporary sublime mood, that is all. Whereas your own, the way you develop your own power of attentiveness in the right way, without reacting for or against anything, that is the whole secret of it, then you will realize your true humanity. So, we'll go on. The author of the creation hymn in the Rig Veda is named Prajapati Parameshthin. Prajapati means the Lord of all creatures and creation. Prajapati. Praja is the population. You see, Lord of all humanity. And Parameshthin means the Supreme Being. Now, these old poet seers, perfected holy ones, who produced the Rig Veda, they realized this state of holistic consciousness. They never put down their own personal names. They always took an assumed name. You know, there are Swamis in London, Swami Avyaktananda, or Swami Paramananda, or whoever it is, and so on. The Ananda part is the blissful part, you see, and the part which comes before, Avyakta means unlimited, Avyakta, you see, and so on. So, they do all these things, but of course, these holy ones who produced the great scriptures, they had a perfect right to do so. They were true Mahayogis, Maharishis. We have heard of rishis, and Maharishi in this country too. Rishi is a singer of a song, the song of eternal life. They were the psalms of life, just as you have psalms in the Old Testament. These were the songs of eternal life which the great rishis sung. You see? And they were entitled. But they never... The title was given to them by their disciples and by the people who venerated them. They gave them the title. They never had the presumption to assume titles such as Maharishi, Mahayogi, or any such thing like that. You know how humility is emphasized in one of the earliest virtues emphasized in all the religions. Now, the name Elijah in the Old Testament, Elijah means God himself, Eliyah. The word El, Ele, the name means the strong one, the one to be worshipped, the one worthy of worship. And Yah is the is part of the name Yahweh. The Hebrew letters Yod, He, Vav, He, you see, they actually represent male, female in conjunction. But of course the Jews won't have that at all. They represent the positive and negative, the male and female aspects of all the creative activity which is the universal process. That is what Yahweh really stands for. The name, then there is the name of another one of these teachers, Brihadeva. Brihadeva, in his in the hymns that he wrote, one of the hymns, declares that he had thrown open all the doors of light. And this is said by Brihadeva at least 1,000 years before the Buddha declared, open are the doors of deathlessness. The name alone, however, is not the sole indicator of him who knows communion. His exemplary life and his teaching prove the name. We must remember that these perfected holy ones were the embodiment of truth, of love, of wisdom, of goodness, of purity. Of beauty. Beauty did not receive sufficient emphasis until the time of Plato. You know Plato's great trinity, truth, goodness, beauty. And beauty is essential because beauty has no criterion like the criterion which we use in terms of art and poetry and everything else. All our criteria, man-made criteria, are related to the fact that that is how we like it. But the good God made a universe which is of such a nature that there are innumerable things we don't like. Which we would say are terrible. You know, it is said that galaxies clash, coincide. Galaxies collide. But do you know how galaxies collide? Have you ever seen one galaxy colliding with another? In any galaxies, the stars composing that galaxy are not millions or billions, but at least trillions of miles apart. So, the colliding of one galaxy with another is very much like a celestial ballet. They move through each other perfectly. You watch a perfect ballet, how the people, the men and the women, they sort of, you think, oh, they are going to clash. Oh, not at all. They just move past each other beautifully. And that is beauty. It gives you delight, doesn't it? How many of you don't go to the ballet? You don't. Nor do I. But when I was a little boy, when I was at Cambridge, then I went several times to the ballet. I saw Pavlova, Nemkinova, Markova. I played the piano for Markova at one of our recitals there in Cambridge. And so on. You see? And it's wonderful, it is beautiful. But there you are. Galaxies clashing are a celestial ballet. We can make a celestial ballet of our lives, even when we clash in reality. Supposing two people start quarreling with each other, accusing each other, oh, you really are thoughtless and inconsiderate and so forth, you see. But then if one of them has the sense to point out where we don't clash and where we do this, that and the other for the other, you see, and the other does similarly for us, what happens to the quarrel? It may come to an end. But then, there are not so many people who have that much sense. See, we have to laugh at life.
Yes.
Very significant is the presentation of the teachings in the form of the divine dialogue. In several Upanishads, a short question is asked, the answer to which is put into the mouth of one or other of the three persons of the Trinity, the Hindu Trinity. In the Maitreya, Maitreya is answered by Mahadeva, the great god Shiva. in the Kaivalya, Ashvalayana is answered by Brahma, the creator. In the Atma Bodha, the teaching is given by Narayana, the supreme being, and so forth. You see, the point is that various are the approaches to the supreme communion in silent aloneness. You have to ask your deep questions of yourself. Don't ask another person. What another person tells you or conveys to you will not be your unique realization. Each and every one of us is a unique person. There is no one else in the world like any and every one of you. And that applies to the whole world. And one of our tasks in life is to realize that uniqueness. But realize it in a way which doesn't make us conceited. You see, this is the important thing. If you feel conceit, then believe me, you have not discovered your true uniqueness. Because the countless uniquenesses of the whole universe are all embraced within the supreme uniqueness of the one total reality. So discover uniqueness in that way, and you'll be in harmony with the entire universe. In that state, of course, as I said earlier too, the brain has stopped talking. You are silent. In the silence, you enter the adytum, the innermost temple. In the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, it is said that the organism, the body, is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the third person of the Trinity. The Shiva is sometimes regarded as the destroyer. But actually, he is the regenerator. And in order to regenerate, you have to change the old structure. Take, for instance, a commoner garden example in building. If an old house is really in a very bad state, a developer buys it off, breaks down the old house, and builds a new one, you see. It's a regeneration process in relationship to the third person of the Trinity, not a destructive process. When the heart grows still with the touch of beauty, when self so surrenders that passion meets love as the river meets the sea, when the mind is so free of all images that truth shines shadowless, or when the votive act flows into the heart of infinite grace, there are no gates to bar the way to your own fulfillment. We'll have to stop there now.